Hello there, and thank you for joining me today on Geezers of Gear, episode number 231. Geezers of Gear, episode 231. Today's guest is Mickey Kerbishley. And so this is the first time ever we're trying this go live thing. So we're promoting our sponsors live and also recording it for the podcast at the same time. Sarah convinced me I needed to do this. And so here I am, I'm doing it. And so welcome. And so this episode is sponsored by AVL Media Group, your premier North American distribution partner. As the exclusive U.S. distributors for Midas Pro consoles, Lab Group and amplifiers, Lake processors, Tannoy installation speakers, Clark Technique, is it Technique or Technic? I've heard it both ways. Clark Technic signal processing, Turbo Sound loudspeakers, and Aston microphones. They are committed to developing long-term business relationships with their partners at every level by providing outstanding pre- and post-sale service and support. AVL Media Group, your premier North American distribution partner. Visit their website, www.avlmediagroup.com. And this podcast is also brought to you today by the ESA. Safety must always be an event professional's ride-or-die partner. The Event Safety Alliance, ESA, works tirelessly to advance the culture of safety across the event industry on behalf of audiences, artists, and those who do the hard work on their behalf. The Event Safety Alliance focuses on the knowledge, behaviors, and guidance that provides the ability to plan and respond consistently, empowering event professionals of all stripes to identify and mitigate risks. ESA education, training, standards, and guidance, and the thought leadership is helping to shape safety at live events for this generation and the next. Become a partner of the Event Safety Alliance and join thousands of event professionals from around the globe, creating a safer, more prosperous future for our industry. Advance your knowledge by becoming a member today at eventsafetyalliance.org. Hello again. This whole live thing is weird. It's a little stressful. I've never done it before. Well, I've done live before, but I've never done this one before. And so it just feels a little bit weird. And so hello, welcome. Thank you for checking this out live on Facebook. Where did I do this? Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube. I think that's it. And knowing you guys, probably nobody is watching or everyone's watching because you're waiting for me to fall on myself. By the way, I did want to make an honorable mention to the gentleman who recorded that wonderful track that is our intro and outro, Greg Godovitz. The song is Godo Sweet Thing. It was a big hit back in, don't know, probably the early 80s, I would guess. And it's Greg's birthday today. So happy birthday, Greg. And we also are getting Greg back on the podcast. We had him on very, very early on in the early days of Geezers of Gear, and we're going to have him on again soon. Sarah's working with him on figuring out those dates right now. So just a couple things to talk to you about before I stop the live recording and then go into, or I should say the live broadcast, and then I go into recording mode where we will continue to record today's guest, who's Mickey Kerbishley, and I'll tell you more about him in a minute. But first, the ProLite show that's going on right now in Frankfurt, Germany. If you're there and watching this, why? You should be drinking beer or doing something fun right now as opposed to watching this live. But if you are there, I'm jealous. It's a great show. I've been to it many, many times. It's a huge show. It's not as big as it used to be because I don't think it's combined with Mesa anymore, but I've been seeing videos and pictures, and it looks massive. The big booths are really big this year. Roby's really big. Some of them are massive. Other ones are surprisingly small. From what I've seen, Martin looks pretty little, and that's surprising considering what they've got going on. Speaking of Martin, you know, they did just launch a product that I happen to love, which is called Mac One. You know, little mini wash light that I think they're probably selling bazillions of right now. And, but obviously their big news for this show, and you've probably seen this 1,000 times already, is Martin has officially launched the new Viper LED, which is not called Viper LED. It's called Viper XIP. And I'm going to have somebody on from Martin at some point to explain why they've gone to IP54 instead of IP65, which is what the rest of the world has decided you need for a weatherproof light. Martin, it's, you know, some magical trickery that they've got this thing that they're calling IP rated, but it's IP54. And I'd love to have somebody on. So if anybody from Martin hears this, don't be angry with me. I'm just questioning why, as a buyer of that product, should I believe that it's okay to put it on an outdoor installation, which is basically what your literature says, that the Aura and any of the other XIP products, if there are any. But again, I hear this Viper is beautiful. I've seen the video. It looks amazing. It's got some great features. It looks bright. And it looks like a worthy replacement to a light that's still super popular. Like I just saw, I forget which big tour I saw, just put up some images the other day that was hundreds of Vipers on the show. But we sell them all the time on GearSource too. Vipers are still a really, really hot light. So congrats to Martin on, first of all, the Mac One, which I think is a massive winner. And now also the Viper, the Viper XIP, which should also do extremely well. So congratulations. Good on you, Martin. In some other big news, so on product news again, I've seen a lot of the Elation stuff popping out. I don't know what the names of any of it are, unfortunately, sadly. I'm sorry, guys, even though they're a sponsor, they haven't given me any advance notice on this stuff. So, Sarah, you need to talk to these people about advance notice on some of their new products so we can talk it up a little bit. But I have seen their follow spot fixture, which is a really interesting move for a company that doesn't really make a follow spot system, to come out with a really bright, really awesome, and probably priced extremely well purpose-made follow spot fixture. So awesome move. I think it's a smart move. I think it'll be great. I saw, and I forget what it's called. I'm sorry, but I think it's called Pulse. It's a rectangular strobe fixture like they've had in the past and others have had as well, but it's got pan and tilt and a lot of really cool features. Just looks like an amazing product. I'm sure they'll do incredibly well with it. And I know there's other stuff too, but again, I didn't really get advance notice, so I'm just going on posts that I'm seeing on social media and stuff. So good job by Elation. Roby, I'm sure they have a lot of new products. I've seen a couple of them posted on social media again, but I don't have much information on those. But they also announced in a press release that they have acquired Australian control company, LSC. And I'm still figuring that one out. That artistic license, I'm also figuring out. I mean, the Avalites deal made sense to me. That one I understand. You know, when you're competing against some massive global distributors who are selling both console and light, or some manufacturers as well, companies like Elation with the Obsidian line, you know, it seems to make some sense. Also, I think it's sort of like peanut butter and chocolate. Like Roby has amazing manufacturing. Avo has really cool product, but probably needs some improved manufacturing capabilities and also size, you know, just resources. So to me, that deal looks like peanut butter chocolate. It looks like it could be a huge winner. I don't know about this LSC deal. I didn't know about the artistic license deal. They're obviously going in a direction. I'm just not sure what that is yet. It looks to me like maybe installations, like Roby's pushing hard to get into more massive installations. And if so, great. You know, that's a beautiful world. And then, you know, for me, the biggest news that I've heard out of this show, and I did know about it a little bit before the show, but actually a few days before the show, But a really nice company that was built by Glenn O'Donohue and his partners and staff and everything else, Ambersphere in the UK, a company that I've been fond of for a number of years. They were the Clay Packy distributor for a long time. They're now the Ayrton distributor. They are the MA Lighting distributor and a lot of other lines as well. Glenn is a great guy. Glenn's a smart guy, been around the industry in the UK for a long time. And I couldn't be happier for him in announcing that he has been acquired by some other very close friends of mine and also a sponsor of our podcast, ACT Entertainment. So ACT from North America, if you've been sleeping and you haven't heard the news yet, ACT from North America has acquired Ambersphere in the UK. And that's important for a lot of reasons. You know, number one, there's a lot of similarities. There's a lot of, stuff that makes sense in that deal. The fact that now they're collectively probably five times bigger than the next largest MA Lighting or Ayrton dealer or distributors. I think, and I haven't talked to Ben about this, and Sarah is reaching out to Ben to get him on the podcast next week so we can discuss it. But to me, it looks like a move into Europe. Not just the UK. And so we'll see. We'll see what the world domination plans from ACT are on making that move. I think it's a fantastic move. I was really excited when I heard about it. And it's a winner. And two great companies with a lot of similarities. And good on you. So congratulations to ACT and congratulations to Ambersphere and especially Glenn, who is now retiring. And he's announced that on LinkedIn. So you know, we know from KISS that nobody ever unretires. And so good on you, Glenn. Congratulations and good luck with whatever it is you choose to do next. Hopefully it's not just gardening and cooking. Hopefully you do something exciting that's related to our industry as well. And so other news, Geezer's new website is launching tomorrow and it's nothing spectacular. It's just a very basic website. But if you've gone to geezersofgear.com in the past month or so since we moved our hosting over to Spotify, we haven't had a website. So, not a lot of complaints because I don't think a lot of people used our website, but it's a great place for guests to find us, for potential sponsors to find us, or for people who don't like using any of the podcast platforms. You can just go directly to our site. You can pick the one that you want to listen to, click on it, and boom, it starts playing. It's very simple. So that will be launched tomorrow. Again, it's geezersofgear.com, of course. And big thanks to Sarah and her spouse who actually helped us get that site up. So it didn't cost us a huge amount of money. They were very helpful and got that launched in a fairly short period of time. So we now have a website popping up tomorrow. What else? Another thing that our lovely and talented producer is working on is a monthly newsletter. And so I'm not sure what that's going to be called yet. I'm not sure what exactly it's going to look like. It's totally a project and product of Sarah. And so that's going to be fun. It's another way to promote our guests, another way to bring on guests, another way to promote our sponsors. And, you know, that's that and telling stories is what this is all about. And so I look forward to that. That's exciting. And just a lot of more exciting things are happening and time to jump on board. If you're not already a sponsor and you're interested, reach out to producer at geezersofgear.com. If you're interested in being a guest on the show, reach out to producer at geezersofgear.com. She'll get you scheduled. And that's about it for that. So today's guest, as I said, Mickey Kerbishley. We're very happy to have Mickey back on the podcast. Last time we had him on was in September of 2019 before shit hit the fan, before the world went crazy. And, you can listen to that episode, which was, I believe, episode 45. And you can hear his incredible story, his incredible background, how he got into the industry by selling t-shirts on tour with AC/DC. And his first, he did his first lighting tour with Elton John. By the way, I haven't mentioned yet, but growing up with a legendary father who was tour manager and manager and all kinds of things, producer, and but working with artists like The Who and Robert Plant, Jimmy Page, so many. Just an incredible family, really. That name, the Kerbishley name, is synonymous with the concert business. But 5 years later, we're going to hear everything Mickey's been up to. He's now the president of Solotech, with some incredible stories to tell from that journey as well. And one of the things that's really important both to Mickey and to Solotech and to myself as well with my sort of circular economy company at GearSource is sustainability as it impacts and as our industry impacts sustainability. So we're going to talk about that a bit. And so Mickey has an incredible work ethic, great guy, excellent stories. So I am now going to end our live broadcast and move on to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me here today. I appreciate you and I hope you love the podcast. Mickey.
Hello, hello.
How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for asking.
You look well. Thanks for having me back. You look well. Look very well.
You know, you take the boy out of London and you dump him in California with all this sunshine and fresh air. And it seems to serve me well.
You know, I don't know if you listen to any of these like longevity health guys, like functional medicine and all of that kind of stuff that helps you age a little more gracefully. It looks like you do. But there's a lot to that. You know, there's a lot to getting sunlight in the morning, you know, like people have spent so much time staying, oh my God, I can't get sun, I'm going to get cancer. But it's incredibly important to get at least 15, 20 minutes of sunlight every day, especially in the morning when it's not as dangerous. And and also to ground yourself, you know, like, I don't know, have you ever heard of a guy called Gary Brecka? He's one of those.
I haven't heard of him, no.
Do you know who Dana? Do you know who Dana White is from the UFC?
Yes. Yeah.
So Dana just recently went through a whole transformation where he lost like, I don't know, 50, 60 pounds. He went from being a fat, you know, drunk, bad eating, heart attack victim waiting to happen to like having a six pack. Like he's so fit now. And this Gary Brecka is the guy who got him there. But one of the things Gary Brecka talks about is grounding yourself. And so people use these grounding mattresses now where they actually literally ground your body. But Brecka just talks about you just take your shoes off and go outside and stand on the grass.
Stand on the ground. Absolutely. Yeah. The funny thing, a lot of people that know me from back in England, from Birmingham and London, would be shocked to hear that. I wake up every morning at 5 a.m. before it gets light. I do an hour of yoga. I walk my dog for an hour. We climb up to the wisdom tree by the Hollywood sign. And it's exercise and fresh air and vitamin D, like you say. If you haven't got
good for you.
You don't get that. If you don't get it from sunlight, you have to get it from your food, which is much, much harder. It takes so much more to get it from sunlight. Good point.
I mean, it's so important. And it's why guys at our age and beyond are able to sustain a career in such a crazy industry, you know, when people who work for law firms and stuff are retiring at 55 or 60 and, you know, guys are working into their 70s in this industry quite easily. Speaking of which, is your dad still working?
He is. I saw him recently. He's around about 80 years old and he looks fantastic. He's still,
that is incredible.
They're still doing the farewell tour that they started in 1984. So it's a, that's hilarious. You know, you can still get tickets if you're quick for the farewell tour. But he's doing great. He's looked after himself for a long time. I quit drinking probably 10 years ago, which made a big difference as well. Yeah. You know, it's not just the LA lifestyle. You don't just move to LA and everything works out. Yeah, there's a lot of work involved. I quit drinking nearly 10 years ago and that made a big difference.
Good for you. So, good for you. Yeah. You know, it's funny because I remember last time you were on the podcast, I think it was you who told the story. I can't remember if it was you or Wiseman who told the story of scuba diving in Australia.
That was probably me, but Wiseman was, he was the instigator. And there's a lot more stories. When I saw the little note that I got about the call, about this, having this call, and there was a bit on it, did you have any stories that you want to share? I mean, obviously, you know, me and Wiseman have a long and colorful history, shall we say.
Yeah.
And some of the stories that just, even now you just sit and think about them and you can just cry laughing. Some of the,
it's hilarious.
We got ourselves in. We got ourselves in such pickles so regularly.
Well, that particular story has been told a lot of times to a point where I've probably completely screwed it up. But as I recall, you were going over on a job interview to work for Verilite. And
well, what happened was, I was on tour with Eric Clapton and we were in Australia and Wiseman showed up randomly at the Siebel townhouse and just said, we stayed up drinking all night. And as we were going to bed, he was like, come on, we should go scuba diving in the morning because we're right by the Barrier Reef or wherever we were. So we all carry on drinking all night. We don't go to bed. We go down to the beach and we rent a load of scuba gear. And it takes us forever to get the gear on because we're so drunk and in a ridiculous state. And we climb into the water and it's just churn. We don't see anything. It's just mud and dirt and it's horrendous. We can't see our hand in front of our face until Wiseman throws up. And then you've got nothing but you've got 10,000 fish just appear from nowhere.
Oh my God.
And then do what they do and then disappear again, like 10 seconds later, just eat everything and disappear.
Yeah.
It was the most, and then at the end of it, we were like, this is just too much. And we stand up and we realize we're in like 3 feet of water. We haven't left the break and there's all kids watching us. Anyway,
God, horrified. The kids are horrified. I'm sure these two drunken idiots pop up, you know, one's covered in puke. And oh my God. Yeah, that's
there
hilarious.
Was there was more than a few of us. There was because Tom Kenny was there. There was so many people. There was like a dozen of us in there in scuba.
Really?
Yeah. The whole crew went.
One of those ingenious moments where John is an interesting guy. You know, there's loads of people. You probably know a lot more than I do, but there's not that many people who can survive what that guy put himself through, you know, with the, as heavy as his habits were and come out the other end. And he's such a great guy now and he's so healthy and fit and well. And, I had dinner with him a couple weeks ago. He was down here actually for a Trump event. He went to a party at Mar-a-Lago and we went out to dinner. So
that's so John. He's a legend, and I was so lucky to have worked with him when I did in the 80s and 90s.
He was a lot of fun. So your dad's 80 and he's still doing what he did, and just The Who or other bands as well?
No, he's got other bands that he manages, and you know he's got a company, Trinifold, that manages a bunch of different bands that published. He manages golfers as well. He's got a new thing where he's managing a load of golf, you know, up and coming golf stars. They invest in them. They back their careers, and then, you know, hopefully they do it in almost like a timeshare thing. I'll probably butcher what it actually is, but I believe you can buy shares in golfers and you invest in it because they need money to get them. You know, they can't, the winnings, it takes a long time for the winnings to come, I guess.
Yeah. I should talk to him because racing is very similar. And I know some drivers who have done it in racing, and my son's a race car driver and, you know, doesn't have the funding to compete with most of these people. And the problem in racing, it really does come down to funding. At the end of the day, it's you know, the rich will rise to the top and the poor
exactly.
will not.
They're from wealthy families. Most of those drivers, you're right, they're from wealthy families. Even the beginning, doing the go-kart stuff, you know, if you start at that go-kart level, it's not cheap, is it?
You'll spend $1 million before you get to cars, you know, it just in go-karts. Right. I mean, we did it, you know, he started at 6 years old and went into cars a few years ago. And it's been a very expensive child.
Yeah.
He's been an expensive child. Yeah. Now he's having fun. He's coaching and stuff right now because he couldn't afford to do this year because his dad pulled back. And we've got some really great sponsors, including in our industry as well. But, you know, I do know a few drivers who have done exactly what you just said. They've basically sold futures and that has worked out really well with a few of them. One of them I think is in the process of being sued now because he made it and then sort of canceled on his investor and so the investor is chasing him now. That's not very cool.
That's a bad feeling.
Last time we talked was 2019, and so we're not going to go through all the career stuff. You, of course, have had an incredible career up until now, and you continue to have an incredible career. One thing I will remind people who are listening is that from what I recall, you actually got your start at selling t-shirts on an AC/DC tour.
Yep, I started off actually selling t-shirts outside Brixton Academy for Desmond Decker. A friend of mine had made some t-shirts and we went and stood on the pavement outside. And that night there was a robbery and they tear gassed the venue and broke into the box office and stole all the money. And it was on the news. By the time I got home, my dad was sitting there and it was on the news. And I just said to him half-heartedly, hey, I was there. I was at that show selling t-shirts. And I was probably 15 or 16. And I was coming up to 16, I believe. And I knew that my schooling was going to be over at 16. I wasn't academic and I knew I was going to be leaving school at 16. And he said, listen, if you want to sell t-shirts, Brockham, the guy that runs Brockham, Peter Lubin, is a friend of mine, and he got me a job selling t-shirts at the NEC for AC/DC.
Huh.
And the first night there, I had no idea I was going to go on tour. I just got the train to Birmingham with nothing, you know, a packed lunch. I had an apple and a sandwich, and I'd never sold, you know, I sold t-shirts at the NEC. I said goodbye to everybody, and I went home. And I traveled through the night. I slept at the station overnight. I walked, you know, back to my parents' house. And when I got home, my mum was like, what are you doing here? They've been calling all morning. You're supposed to be on tour. You're supposed to have, you're like, and I, they had a hotel for me and everything at the NEC.
Oh my God.
That's how naive I was. I had no idea that they even had a hotel. And they just assumed that you know, I knew all this.
Both sides assumed.
And then, so
right?
I went back. Yeah, so I went back the next day and toured with AC/DC for probably 6 months with Jake Berry as the production manager.
Wild.
That was my introduction to that, and I just fell in love with it. 16-year-old kid and was blown away by.
Well, you were pretty life. Much you were yeah. pretty much destined anyways because of your father, right? Like, you weren't going to go be a, you know, a lawyer or a, well, maybe a lawyer, but
no.
You probably weren't going to be a, you know, a normal job yeah. kind of guy.
I think I was probably destined for greater things than I ended up with, like, you know, rigging for Howard Jones. I was probably, my dad probably thought that, you know, I don't know what he thought about that as a career choice, but
yeah,
it turned out okay in the end. I stuck with it for a very long time. And like anything, if you stick with it and it was hard working. Well, I tell you, it's the opposite to these days because the technology was so minimal.
Yeah.
It was literally a parkan with a piece of gel in front
yep.
that you moved and you tightened it up and then you climbed onto the next one. That was as technical as it got. It was really about who could stay up the, how long can you stay up? Can you load trucks in the pouring rain? You know, and you know, now of course it's a different skill set.
It's so different. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah. The entire business is so different now. You know, like I was just hearing, somebody told me this morning, I got to go look at my text and see who it was. Someone I've heard has just taken on a bunch of private equity money. And which company was it? Oh, Rental.
Oh, really? Okay.
In Belgium.
Europe. Yeah. The big dry hire company. Great company.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's getting to a point now, and we can talk about this because you mm-hmm. obviously are part of one of the big private equity held companies. I think it's
well.
Getting
I would. We need to because that's really interesting. We're not private equity. We are. It's privately owned by Stephen Bronfman. He owns the majority of it. Who's a wealthy individual from Canada, from the Seagrams family.
Yeah.
Who is a passionate music guy. And then there's other investors that are more. It's not private equity.
Okay.
But just because that does make a difference, by the way, on the subject.
Yeah, it does
make a difference on the subject, but there's a lot of that about. But yeah.
Very different in the operation of the company and stuff too. Bronfman also didn't, and I don't know if he still does, but at one point he owned Universal Music or something too, didn't he?
He did. They sold that recently. The great thing about Stephen was that a lot of people don't know is he. I don't think he'd mind me sharing it, but his was the money behind a lot of those early 360 deals that Live Nation did. They him and Michael Cole, I believe it was those guys that really funded that change in the industry.
Yeah. So. Which has been a fairly epic change, a pretty big change, really, right? But where I was going with the, and again, I misspoke on the private equity thing, but let's call it funded by deep pockets, you know, whether that's a private individual or a private equity group or a public entity or whatever it is. But I think the industry now has gotten to a point where even if you're a large rental company or whatever, it's you're going to hit a wall where you just don't have, you know, the capital or resources to compete on some of these shows. Like they're getting and have gotten so ridiculously huge that I don't know, like as a rental company, how could you, like a bid comes across your desk for, you know, a Beyonce stadium tour or a, you know, Taylor Swift or whatever, any of the big ones that are out. And I mean, the equipment list has to be just ginormous, you know?
They're 20, 30, $40 million investments for those things. And you know, I mean, it's such a big subject that you could talk about for a long time, but yes, you need deep pockets. You need, the thing about our industry is all of our clients want you to be, if they want it to be a cottage industry, but they also want you to be able to stump up $10 million at very short notice when they finally make their mind up as to what it is they really, really want on their, on their show, you know? And that comes down to the, you know, the question we were talking prior to going live on it about sustainability and about, you know, the sheer.
Yeah.
You
know, and I want to get into that, but the enormity of these shows, is that driven by artist ego or lighting company ego or production manager ego or a combination of all of those? What is it?
I used to think it was ego, but I don't know that it is. I don't really see that. I see it as just, you know, the public expect a certain level. I think some of it is to do with the artists and the shows that people are now used to seeing. You know, when we were younger, we would go see, we spoke about The Who earlier and about that. I remember some of my earliest experiences of going to the Rainbow in London, and the show was a black box at the end of in a theater. So there was no safety lighting, for instance. So you didn't see anything. You just had to focus on the band. There was no LED. There was just a black drape behind it, and there would be the artist, and they would be lit, and that was the show. That was your focus. Was on that. Over the years, it's become so much more that even the audience are part of the show now. Yeah. So often the audience is still part of the show. So you're lighting every element of it. I think that really took hold when we started filming shows, and, you know, Alan Branton and people like that came along, and they were like, you know something, you need to see what's going on out here. The public want to see what's going on. So that's when it really started to expand lighting wise to bringing in the audience into it. But, and the scenic stuff, the stuff that Tate do now is, you know, it's so complex and it is a bit of an arms race. It's like, you know, we know that these artists go to see each other's shows. They go, so someone, you know, Taylor Swift, even if it's not her, somebody will go and see somebody, you know, the Beyonce thing, or Beyonce will see her show, or whatever. And then their designers will be watching each other's shows, and they'll have to keep, it's got to be fresh. It's got to be different. It's got to be, because it's the same audience, the same person that goes to see each show.
Yeah, so, yeah, of course. You got to step it up. You got to keep stepping up the game, because otherwise it gets boring. And, you know, obviously ticket prices are getting higher. But is it the ticket prices that are driving up the size of the show, or is it the size of the show that's driving up the ticket price? Again, it's always a chicken and egg sort of argument, I guess. But I was just curious, like if Beyonce goes and sees Taylor Swift and she's got 1,000 lights, I want 1500 lights, or she's got a, you know, 20 meter screen, I want a 30 meter screen or whatever, right? There's got to be some of that,
I think,
I'm guessing.
There's an element of that, but I think a lot of it is also they go and they look at it, and if they're impressed with it, they're like, okay, I want to talk to the people that did that.
Yeah.
Can you connect me to the team that are responsible for that show? And then they go in and they decide on elements that they like of it, and elements that they don't, and their own thing, and that's when you, you know, so that, yeah, that I think is probably where it comes from.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, again, they're just becoming so huge that it's just like, where's all this coming from? And, you know, the other thing that's so interesting, and I've said it so many times on my podcast, but everything's a stadium show now, you know, like you're starting to see comedians doing stadiums and mm-hmm. Country acts doing stadiums. Not that there's anything against country acts, but I mean, yeah. It's not just the Rolling Stones doing stadiums anymore, or U2. It's so many bands doing stadiums. And I love the creativity of the design and production people in building these rigs out, because obviously you don't have a ceiling to fly lights from or whatever. You know, there's no rigging, so everything's from the ground pretty much, and it's a whole different thing.
I've recently become a Kenny Chesney fan, you know, which is another thing that would surprise my Cockney friends back home.
Yeah. But country music's not so big in England, right?
I went to see Kenny Chesney a few years ago in a stadium somewhere in Florida. I've never seen anything like it in my life. If you've not been to a Kenny Chesney show, if you've never been to a Kenny Chesney stadium show, it's the biggest party that I've ever attended. It's
really?
So much fun and so much energy. And you can see why they want to be in a stadium, because it's just the whole place is just on fire. It's just the biggest party. Anyone who hasn't been to a Kenny Chesney show, I would advise it.
I'm going to have to check that out.
It totally took me by surprise.
Yeah. I never would have guessed that'd be the big party, you know? Is it the audience or the artist though that's creating the party
audience
atmosphere?
And the artist, yeah. They're all so familiar with everything. They know, you know, I was never really around for the tailgate parties, you know, the Grateful Dead and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I was touring with The Who at the time, and I remember pulling up at stadiums and the Grateful Dead fans would still be there the following week. So they would all still be in the car park. They would do alternate weekends. So we would arrive on a Friday for a Saturday show, and their show was Saturday, and the car park was still had 800-900 people in it. Like, but it's similar to that, I believe, the Kenny Chesney vibe.
Speaking of Deadhead fans, I remember when they opened the Mirage in Las Vegas, I had provided some lighting there. So I was invited to the grand opening of the Mirage Hotel. And I was staying there, I think, from maybe 2 days before the opening. And the same weekend, Grateful Dead was playing at the racetrack, the Speedway in Las Vegas, I think.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was the football stadium. I don't remember. But they were playing at something big. And so in this brand new hotel that was just opening that weekend, there were these Grateful Dead fans sleeping in sleeping bags in the hallways and showering in the casino bathrooms, like washing themselves down and brushing their teeth and blow drying their hair or whatever in the casino bathrooms. It was just hilarious. It was so funny. They're an interesting bunch. Yeah.
And they're not. I thought they were going into the Sphere, but they're not, are they? I don't think them. I know Fish is going in there, aren't they? I don't think Dead and Co.
Does Grateful Dead still tour as Grateful Dead? I don't even know.
No, it's Dead and Co. They still go and do shows, and they're still very popular. I know that. I know Chris Adamson was working with them up until a while ago, and they were doing really, really well.
But you say Fish is going into the Sphere? They're like for a
residency? That's what I heard. I think it'll be a short residency. I don't think it's as long as the U2 thing was 40 shows, I believe. But
they'll
still be.
How successful
I would imagine they'll do a few shows.
That thing.
It was another thing. Not many things blow me away, you know, because we've been doing it for so long. But going there with no real expectation, I hadn't paid attention. We were involved in the building of it. We built the outside of the Sphere, but we didn't do anything on the inside. And Willie and his team had been working there. So I went, I had some lunch with Willie, and then I stayed and watched the show. I've never seen anything like it in my life. And even to this day, there's a bunch of effects that they did that I have no idea how they did it. And this is what I do for a living and have done since I was 16, as we just said.
Yeah.
If you get a chance, unfortunately U2 has finished.
Yeah.
That's another thing. We're lucky. Recently, it's been really not boring, but there's not really been that much innovation in what we do. We've been talking about stadium shows. Yes, they're getting bigger, but they're bigger and more of the same thing in a way.
Yeah.
But what they did there in the Sphere, and I was as cynical as any of the rest of us, believe me.
Yeah.
It's just the idea of it, what are they doing, billion, you know, whatever. And, you know, who knows what where it will go. But what I saw with you two blew me away. Stunning.
Yeah. I had a long talk with our mutual friend John about that. And I don't know. I'm still cynical about it. Like, I just think, like, when I won't forget the very first video I saw of you two in the Sphere. And it took me a good 30 seconds to find Bono on video. I couldn't find him. Like, where is he? I couldn't find him anywhere. And I'm looking everywhere because it's just such a, it's a visual just orgasm. You know, it's just this visual. There's so much shit going on that it to me just takes all the focus away from the artist. And
it's a different form of entertainment.
It's a different medium.
Would if you two showed up there, would they, without that, would they sell 40 nights at the Sphere in Vegas?
No.
Of course
not. I don't think so.
No, but putting it together was genius, and you know, the work that those guys did, just the, I appreciate so much what it takes, what it took to do it. You know, that's what I appreciate is that. Yeah. And that they are taking a risk. And like, when we talk about the ABBA show that we're involved in London, like I say, we weren't involved in any way with what happened in the Sphere and what Willie and Treatment and those guys did.
Yeah.
But I can respect it and look at it and be like, I was blown away. Not going to lie.
Yeah, that, totally that ABBA thing is cool too. That could probably make it in the Sphere for a little while, you know, a month or something.
It could do, but, you know, that one, you know, if you know, it's another show that I would say, you know, it's not often that I would say, you know, people ask me all the time, hey, what are you doing? What's cool? Because we're involved in pretty much every show that's out there. We're involved in some way or one of our friends is.
Yeah.
And I would say that it's unfortunate if you missed you two, because I don't think anyone will ever do that again. I don't think anyone will ever spend that kind of money on the content. You know, it will end up in a library that you can use. I would imagine a library of content that when you go in there, you can use. So maybe that's something that we'll never experience again, and we won't see again. And it might end up being a big.
That's
it might
be a
big IMAX.
You know, they spent a couple $1 billion building that place, and it had to be that big of a sort of extravaganza kind of thing, like you two for however many nights, and it just had to be that crazy. Because I think, you know, me being cynical, I think a lot of people were like, there's no way they're ever going to make money on this place. They're going to lose their asses and all that stuff. I've kind of turned around my thinking on that because they created such a spectacle out of this show. And now you've got like the UFC going in there. That's another one that really surprises me. Like, what's that going to look like? That's going to be really
weird. That's one that we are heavily involved in. We are putting that together with Silent House. And it's another one. Yeah, obviously there's challenges, lighting from that high up and all that. And I'm not involved in that part of it. But, you know, I think the point is, like, you know, for $2 billion, you could have built the Wynn.
Yeah.
You could have gone and built another casino and had that kind of thing. So, but what they did was they've gone out on a limb. They've gone and done something that, you know, it's
unique.
You know,
there's nothing else like it.
If it just ends up being a giant IMAX cinema at the end of the day, then
it's the world's most expensive IMAX cinema. So what?
Yeah.
You know, somebody's getting a lot of attention. Even the things that they do with that round, like, I'm sure locals in Las Vegas probably get sick of it, but like when you saw the F1 race and the happy face guy with the little eyeballs that would watch the cars go by and the eyes would follow the cars and stuff, like even silly things like that, I think are really cool, you know?
I think there's an element of all of us, especially us that have been in this industry for our entire lives, where we are cynical and we're sort of programmed to shoot things down before, you know, we just do. It's like, it's just our nature, and we always will, generally to ourselves. We don't do it in a format like this, in a public environment or anything like that. But even the Formula One, you know, when they were putting that together, I went to the Formula One. I've got a friend of mine who came from London who's a big fan. You know, he overpaid for his room and all this kind of thing. He got totally, you know, but he had a fantastic time. And I was really cynical about the whole thing. But then when you read afterwards, the drivers, who it's pretty important what they think, they thought it was the best race of the entire season.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Now, there's so many things that were wrong with it in many, many ways. But one element, which is the drivers, were like, this is the best race we've had all season because of the way the course was and this and that. So, you know,
Because of the challenges. Yeah. You know, I think the hardcore racing fans, especially Brits, hated it, you know, because it Brits don't like, and I'm speaking for one right now, but Brits don't tend to like, from a motorsport standpoint, when you get off of the real hardcore fundamentals of motorsport and it's more a show. Like, they hated the Netflix series. They hated the Miami race. Yeah. You know, they hated the whole Vegas thing because it's
the opening ceremony, all that.
They don't like it.
Exactly. All that thing. I get it. And I don't think they'll do that again. I don't know that they will, because they've learned, aren't they? You know, you learn from your mistakes.
One, they lost so maybe much money too. That had to just cost them gazillions of dollars. Like, you know, it was such a shit show financially.
But you know, and we weren't involved in that in any way either. So, you know, when I comment on it, sometimes, you know, you find yourself commenting on things because you've made money from it, or you've done, you know, so I would look at that and be like, oh my God, it was fantastic. Let's do the opening ceremony again. Yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah.
But to me, you know, I didn't watch it. I have no interest in it. Why would I? It got nothing, zero interest.
Shame on you, Mickey. Interest.
Other than my friends were putting it together, you know, I went to see them during rehearsal and stuff and stand there because it's their thing. It's what we do. But there's no difference to me watching that or watching Katy Perry or watching, you know,
it's just another thing.
It's just another big spectacle, you know. So
Back to the UFC thing, and I don't even know if you can tell me, but I would assume that it's going to be like more like a standard, fight where it's in the round. And I'm curious assuming it's in the round with seating around it, what's the content going to be? Like, it's not going to be an IMAG.
It's not that I can't tell you. It's that I don't know, because I'm not. Okay. It's something that Lee Morrow and is working on from our side with John Flynn. They've been in the building and dealing with the Silent House team that are putting it together.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if we've finished bidding on it yet. I don't even know if we've actually awarded it.
You know, again, I'm just curious, with a sporting event, you know, it's not gonna be as crazy as the U2 content was, because it would probably be too distracting, I would think. But who knows? Like, I never in a billion years would have seen U2 doing what they did either. So, you know, it was just so out there and so different than anything, like you said, anything we've ever seen. We've never seen anything like that. So just very, very different. So so I've been listening to this this book called Living the Beatles Legend. Have you seen this book or heard of it or anything? I don't know. Were you a Beatles fan? Did you grow up a Beatles fan?
I was not, but I ended up, when I was tour managing Eric Clapton, George Harrison was in the band. So when I was 25 years old, just before Wiseman, in fact, the tour that Wiseman showed up on in Australia was, we were touring with George Harrison. He was the guitar player. And I didn't really know the Beatles. I'd never really had that much of an experience of them, but I certainly spent time with him and then got into it, to be honest with you. And now I sort of respect him, but
yeah, I do too. I'm very similar. Like, I think I was just a little bit too young. You know, when the Beatles really broke was, you know, 66, 67, 68, whatever.
Yeah.
And I was born in 64. So I was just a bit too young for that. But I've always been intrigued. You know, I've read like John Lennon's book and some other stuff. But this book, Living the Beatles Legend, is based on a diary that was written by a guy named Mal Evans, who was their roadie, right from the cavern all the way up till their very last performance, to their very last recording. And it was him and Neil Aspinall, who worked for the Beatles like right from day one. And he died, and his son always kept this diary and said, one day we're going to write a book. And it's so interesting. I was just curious if you were a fan or anything, because it really,
I haven't read that, but I've read quite a few biographies. I love true, you know, I'll read a bit of fiction, but I prefer historical things. So I love,
so do I.
Biographies and
me too.
You know,
especially music ones. Music biographies are always fun, industry biographies.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, yeah. I know one of the things that's really meaningful and something you're passionate about is something we've already mentioned for a second there is sustainability in our industry. And, you know, in your mind, like, is that something being driven by need or being driven by guilt or like, is it got, is it something related to the size of the shows? Like if we don't do something, we're not going to have enough power in stadiums to run this much shit, you know, or.
I think there's an element of, if we sort of peel it back and go back to where, you know, we all understand that the planet is in crisis, that we can't continue the way we've been going in, you know, such a short period of time, the amount of damage that we've done to the fragile balance of nature is it's just, we have to do something about it. Now, you know, there's a lot of people that, you know, we'll put that focus on individuals and go, okay, you have to recycle, you get an electric car, you change your light bulbs, you do those kind of things, you know. So, you know, there's a lot of focus on that. It's like, okay, what can you do as an individual? Which is, right. You know, fine. We all have our part to play and we all have our thing. But we also know that really, I think the statistic is that 75% of the damage that is done by 100 companies globally. So,
really?
You know, we can make a difference in a tiny thing. But I think that, you know, statistically, there's probably 100 companies that are doing 75% of the damage.
Where'd you get that statistic from? Because I want to look that one up.
From something that I read, but I am no expert on this. I would rather be in a conversation about it than sitting here saying what, you know, because
I'm not going to fact check you. I promise you that.
No, I'd rather be, but to me, what I do know is that, you know, is what we do as entertainers is it leaves a huge footprint. So mm-hmm. I just did a talk last week in London at the International Live Music Conference, and the opening day of the conference is about a greener future. And it's Claire O'Neill has been doing this for many, many years, puts a series of panels together, you know, and we talk about what we can do, what, you know, and it's, and the great thing is, you know, it's full of young people. It's, you know, most of the old people don't even go in there. Most of the older promoters and the people that, you know, it's full of young people. It's the future. It's the people that realize that if we don't do something, they don't have a future in entertainment. Yeah. There's no, you know, we can't keep doing what we're doing. So, and I did this talk, and I'm much more comfortable talking to you than I am standing on a stage in a room. And that, you know, that, and I think most people here will understand that as well, because that's why we chose our thing. I feel really uncomfortable standing in front of a group of people and talking, but it was something that I feel I had to do. And I told a story to start with about the Jonas Brothers 5-6 years ago. We got a design through for the Jonas Brothers, and let's say there were 600 moving lights on it. And when we did the power consumption, it was going to be 4 300 amp supplies for the show. And most buildings, we can get a couple, and then we'd have to have a couple of generators. And, you know, they were doing 70 shows, should we say. And when we did the calculations, it was like, and it was just at the time when LED lights were really starting to take, people were starting to take them seriously, LED lighting. You know, we could start to be able to shape the beam, started to be more reliable, you know. So what we did was we did this calculation. We were like, okay, if we buy an LED lighting rig, what's the power consumption? And it went down to 1 supply.
Wow.
So we were saving 3 300 amp supplies every single day.
Two of which were generators.
Exactly. So we went back to the design team and made this proposition. And they were like, well, if you'll buy those lights, let's do it. It just is a no-brainer. And we had to get a commitment from the design team. They were like, look, this tour is only going for a year. We're going to go spend $1 million on this stuff or whatever it was. You know, will you use it for a couple of years? And they were true to their word. The next show they designed, it went on, and it really made a shift in us. So we started pushing towards LED products. But what it did for me, it woke me up to the fact that you can make a difference. You know, where, you know, if you present it the right way, people have a conscience. People understand. that the impact that we make. And it was just one small thing, and it really got set us on a path of that we haven't stopped on now. Most of our product is LED.
Yeah, one of the things about LED that I never really thought of, and I had an LED company for commercial LED, replacing, you know, large warehouses and buildings and stuff, replacing incandescent or fluorescent or whatever with LED, or, you know, metal halide or whatever. And but one of the things I didn't think about, and Huddleston told me, actually, I think we were on this podcast probably, and Huddleston said one of the biggest differences that LED makes is that from load in and setup, when you turn the lights on until the show starts, that's the biggest difference right there. Like,
they're on.
Lights
they're
on. Are on all day. LEDs are off all day. That's a huge power savings.
He's absolutely right. What happens with an incandescent light is we turn it on in the morning. And the reason we do this is simple. When you're in your house, the only time your light bulb will blow is when you turn it on. Okay, so when you're in a show situation, the last thing you want to do is just before the show, turn all your lights on, because that's when they're going to go. So what we developed over the years was like, let's just turn them all on in the morning and don't touch them. Yeah. And then a shutter is closed in front of them. And when it's showtime, the shutter lifts and does its thing. LED is the total opposite. You hit a button and it goes on.
Yeah, yeah.
That is in itself.
Massive power savings.
Like, you know what that's like doing? It's like brushing your teeth in the morning and leaving the tap on all day long until you brush your teeth in the evening.
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy.
That's what you're doing. That's what we're doing with those lights.
But if you think of it, Mickey, like, so what time lights are generally done in the morning by what? Like noon at least, right?
11. 11 or 12, yeah.
Okay, so let's call it 11. So they're on from 11 o'clock until 10 o'clock at night, or
midnight.
11 o'clock at night.
Until midnight, when the show finishes.
Yeah, the show is 8 until midnight or whatever. So you're going from 4 hours to like 13 hours. So the lights are on for absolutely no use for, you know, more than double the length of the show time. Yeah. It's just completely crazy. You can save 2/3 of the electricity you're drawing.
And we don't, you know, that's the point I'm making. Until we're looking for things, we're all like now going, okay, what can we do to reduce our impact? Something as simple as that is makes such a big difference, you know. And the other thing that we're working on at the moment, one of the things that we're working on, and I had a meeting with Yvonne Donnelly in London, who is the sort of the head of PRG over there, and a really dear friend of mine, and I want to congratulate her recently. She made one of the women of industry in Polestar.
Yeah, I saw.
And you know what I will say is that most of the people that are driving this change are women.
Really?
That most of the, because as always, you know, they're the ones that are sensitive and the ones that are sensitive to what is going on here, and also they're, if I, you know, the people that like Carol Scott at Tate is making a massive impact on our industry and what we do. Claire, that I just spoke about, Claire O'Neill, Amy Morrison, Mo Morrison's wife. She's got a project that's just been going in the US now. So that it's been driven by the women of our industry. A lot of this.
That's interesting. I didn't know.
A lot of this stuff. But the thing that we're doing at the moment, and I spoke to Yvonne about this, is we want to create a greener bid document. So when you get a quote from hire companies, what we want to do is introduce on the back page of it is either a lighting plot that shows you the power consumption of the units that you've chosen, because what you can look at is hypothetically, if you looked at a rig, you've got an LED screen, which is LED, okay? That would generally be classed as a green product. You've got some, you know, you maybe some incandescent, big, bright, powerful lights, which will be red. And then there's a bunch of stuff that sits in the middle that's amber. But if the LED screen was purchased at the very last minute because nobody could make their mind up exactly what they wanted, and we had to air freight it from China, then it goes red, you know?
Yeah.
And the point that I want to make, and the point that I think that where we all have a part to play, is that we're pushing our timelines closer and closer. We're getting shorter and shorter. We're so good at doing, making sure that no matter what, we can deliver and the show will always go on. The difference between what we do and most people do is we know way in advance when the first show is of a tour. So if I'm looking at, if I'm now in whatever we are now in March, I'm looking at shows that the tour might start in August now. And let's say, for argument's sake, it starts at 8 o'clock on August the 1st in Fresno, the artist that I'm working with. I know, we start going through the negotiation period. If we're buying new product, given enough time, I can put those products on a sea container and ship them for literally zero carbon impact almost and very low cost. Yeah. Now, you made a point earlier about how everything's going up in price. Well, the difference between sea freight and air freight of a product is not only massive financially, but as an impact to carbon impact is massive as well. So yeah. Of course the price is going to go up. We will shoulder that burden. That we will be like, okay, we'll pay the extra million. There's a couple of examples right now that we're living through, and everyone's doing the same. Huddleston's doing the same. Yvonne's doing the same. We're all living the same drama, which is last minute, we need this from there. So, and we're air freighting it in. And I've got one at the moment. The charge is $1 million. It's 2 747s full of product that is air freighting in. It's $1 million.
Wow. Now,
I might split that cost with the manufacturer. We might do that. But at the end of the day, that's going to the ticket price. That it is going to hit the ticket price in some way or another, as it would if it was a bottle of water that is going up by that. So. Yeah. You know, what I would say is, like I say, it's lovely talking to you, and it was really nice doing my talk in front of a lot of people, but we need a conversation amongst the decision makers and the people, you know, people with, like myself, like John Huddleston, like John Wiseman, like Yvonne, all these people that are sitting really at the top of this thing. We need to sit down and we need to get serious about this, because we're doing so much unnecessary damage by the timelines that we're allowing ourselves to being presented with, and it's pushing the price up. It's not, yeah. You know, there's a 30% import duty obviously on Chinese product that you know, all the promoters are asking us, why is everything so much more expensive? Why is it 30% more expensive? Well, some of it, yes, is duties and stuff like that, but some of it is just the sheer fact that we're having to,
Mickey, I'll give you an example. Airplanes. You know, there's a few touring companies out there who I won't mention their names, but will use my company GearSource as a, you know, the last minute magician, right? And so It wasn't this year. I think it was last year. I got a call on December 28th, I believe, for a show, and they needed 100 fixtures that were not available anywhere, and they needed them delivered to Nashville to rehearsals. And these 100 fixtures, you know, again, were super tough to get. We could get them. They were going to come out of Singapore. And they said, okay, well, no problem. You know, we'll take them. You know, the lights, I think used, it was probably $500,000 or something. And so no problem, we'll take them. And we said, okay, let's put this all together. And then they said, okay, and we said, you know, is there a drop dead date that you need them in Nashville? Yeah, January 11th. And this is December 28th, you know, right before New Year's. They're coming from Singapore.
Yeah.
Not only are they going to have to go air, but they're going to have to go air in a very special way, like 100 moving lights in dual cases. They're not just going to pop on any airplane, right? This is going to be tough.
Yeah.
So long story short, we managed to pull it off. But freight was $650,000 for $500,000 of lights. I mean, it was just insane. It's why did you wait until December 28th? You know, why?
That's it in a nutshell. Yeah. And sometimes that's coming in cardboard boxes as well, like you say, because you don't have, it's literally piles and piles of cardboard boxes that really do have to be, you know. So I think that we have a duty. There's so much, and there's so much that we are doing. I think one of the big points is that we've come so far. Mm-hmm. But we've got to keep going. We've got to keep working. We've got to work together. You know, we have really come a long way. You know, that it's even down. I remember having a conversation years ago with the promoters in Hyde Park at the time, it was Toby Leighton Pope at Live Nation. And I was like, you know, we've got to do something about the plastic cups. You know, there's we did a calculation there. We're like, there's 1.5 million plastic cups every night or whatever it was in the, I can't remember the number, but it was staggering. And he's like, yep, let's do it. Let's go talk to the beer people. And they went off and spoke to the beer people. And the beer people were like, mate, we can't pour every drink when someone asks for it. So you can't come up with your cup and we then pour you a drink. That we need to have hundreds of beers already poured behind us. So when you walk up and want six, we give you a tray of six and you walk away with them. So you can't do a one cup thing because the beer companies were just like, how does that work for us in our dynamic? I'm way away from that now, but they seem to have made a lot of progress. They've certainly made a lot of progress with the water bottles. People are really used to showing up and filling up something and refilling it and stuff like that. Did great work at Coachella, I believe, on that, and also in Hyde Park. So we've really come a long way, but we've got to be a little bit more. We've got to drive this a little bit. The industry has to take ownership.
Some of it is just simply common sense, too, Mickey. Like it's not. This, you know, certainly there's some politics in involved in all of this where people say, you know, regardless of which side you're on, whether climate change is ridiculous and it's not true and there is no such thing, or climate change is going to end us all and it's the most important thing today. Neither of those really matters in this conversation, because it's common sense. It not only does it save the company money and ultimately save, you know, the end ticket purchaser money, the fan money, but it's just common sense. These are easy solutions to problems that are either this big, you know, and the end of the earth, or they're this big and maybe the earth will continue operating, but still, where are you going to put all this plastic? And, you know, our producer who is British, Sarah, lives on an island, Crete, and she's telling me all the time about the fact that there's nowhere to put garbage. So people just put it everywhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'll go to these beautiful beaches and they'll just be lined with plastic and trash and junk and whatever, because what are you going to do with it? You know, it's a pretty tiny island, right? So, you know, something has to be done, obviously. And, you know, the other thing is, and this may sound self-serving, but I find a lot of companies will buy lights that they could easily rent, or they'll buy new lights that they could easily buy used ones. And it doesn't make a lot of sense, because I think right now the world probably has, you know, 3 million lights and only needs 2 million or whatever that number is, right? And so there's a lot of stuff sitting out there, stale, stagnant, not doing anything right now, because either a designer has to have that one extra gobo or the one new feature or whatever it is. And I know that I'm talking against what most lighting companies would want me to say right now, but it's true. You know, at the end of the day, we just have to be a little more sensible when it comes to using what's there as opposed to just specifying the latest thing that you got to have.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that the point that Yvonne and me were talking about, and I'd like to bring Huddleston in and a few other people on this, is like is developing something, like you say, at the end of a document that shows you the footprint.
I love it.
The carbon footprint of the thing, of what it is the decisions that we've made. Because all of our choices have consequences in everything we do. But specifically during this design process and the bidding process and that, and as we're building, you know, and I think everybody's trying to reduce the amount of trucks they've got because of the financial costs and stuff like that. They still want the big show. And it, you know, so,
I'll tell you where it should happen is, if any of you are using common bidding systems, then whoever creates that system should just build in a very simple AI model that looks at the quote and finds those things and gives you 10 suggestions at the end of it that says, if you use this instead of this, you're going to save X tons of whatever, and you're going to save $50,000 on freight. If you use this instead of this, this is going to happen. You know, we notice you it tightens up and makes your quote more efficient from a standpoint of common sense.
People might like anything, they can drive holes through that. They would be like, but really what it comes down to is that we have to have an agreement on what those parameters are, what those levers are. And it can't be me sitting here saying, because I'll have a slightly different set of criteria than someone like John Huddleston will have. You know, like, for instance, you know, like I say, last minute air freight from China in cardboard boxes, to me, it's the thing that kills me a lot of the time. Yeah. And he might have something different. He's a different thing as well. He's lucky because he's a one location company as well. He's got one location and he's got a trucking company. You know, I'm in multiple locations. I spend so much time and energy and money moving stuff between locations that, you know, I'm
creating
in Nashville,
efficiencies
Vegas, and then moving that. And
which
so,
is very inefficient.
So, you know, so
sometimes.
I might have a different, I might have a different set of criteria and levers that you can pull that will make it. But between us, if we sit down, you know, I might try and take an opportunity for the Lidditz, the gathering that happens every year at Rock Lidditz, to really get with some of these, you know, sit with some of the players and be like, try and build something between now and then.
That makes sense.
We can build into this, you know. So that's, you know, that things like that. I mean, you said, like I said before, I can talk for hours about it, and I'm not an expert. I'm just somebody that cares passionately.
You're passionate about it,
What we do, and I want it to go on forever. I want the young people that are taking over my role to have the same kind of experience that I've had, and I'm scared that you know.
Well, Mickey, that's where it starts, though. It starts with passionate people in powerful positions. Try say that five times really fast. Passionate people in powerful positions, but. You know, to me, that's where it starts. Like somebody says, hey, this is important, and I think it's something we should talk about. And I got involved in a lot of those types of conversations throughout the whole COVID thing. You know, it somebody had to start the conversation. Somebody had to use their voice to get the information out there and talk about it. And then from there, you start developing some solutions. And I think this is one of those things. Like, and it's just developing some common sense patterns. The challenge is, in our industry, you know, if I say I got to have 1,000 ABC lights and, you know, or my show just won't look as good as whatever, and you're saying, no, look, I'll give you 1,000 of these other lights instead because they're here. We don't have to air freight them in. It's going to save the environment and blah, blah, blah. You know, there's a competitor out there somewhere who's going to go, yeah, hey, Bob, I'll get you those 1,000 lights. You know, do it with me. I'll get you those 1,000 lights. And
We can't even agree not to drive all the prices into the ground. So agreeing something like this is people are gonna say it's almost impossible. It's really difficult. But I tell you what, there's got to be a way. I guarantee you that there's some kind of way where we can at least improve it, because that's what we're looking for. Just do it better, smarter, and more efficient.
You know,
and then we save money.
Here's an example of what you just said. So right after, I don't know if you saw, but a couple of weeks ago, the union was able to defeat Four Wall, and they're unionizing in Las Vegas.
Yeah, in Vegas.
So I got a call, and I won't tell you who it was, but it was a competitor to Four Wall who said, great, they'll finally have to push the prices up. You know, is that really what it takes, though, that you get stabbed in the heart with some additional cost or whatever to make you make a positive change like that? Because, you know, I've literally, as big as all of you companies have become, I've felt bad for rental companies for 10 years now, because the math of it all, like, you know, I'm old enough to remember that you used to buy an IntelliBeam for $2,500. You'd rent it for $175 or $200 a week for 10 years, you know, and then you'd sell it for $2,000. You know, I mean, it was just, the math was really good. Now you buy a light for $10,000. It's only a hot light for a couple of years, and then you got to buy the next version, and you're renting that $10,000 light for $200 a week, you know? So, I mean, the math has just gone all the wrong direction on this stuff, which is why you have to have so much private equity involved now.
And you need to be able to move the gear. You need to be able to move it on. You need to have a really good distribution point to get it once it's still in warranty, and you need to get it, you know, you get it. But the trick would be, obviously, like if you go back to the plot that we were talking about, you know, you would have a piece of truss, in my experience, is going to last a very long time. And when it's finished, it's melted down and it's made into another piece of truss, you know, at the end of the day. So, you know, so that's as green as it gets. And then right at the other end of it is the moving light that is only good for a year. It's incandescent, or even the LED lights now that are you know, that, you know, it's not, maybe they need to be more modular. Maybe they need to be fixable on the road more than, you know, they don't need to be sent back to be fixed when certain things happen to them. Maybe they need to be modular. And when there's an upgrade, you can slip the upgrade in there like you can on most other things. Not that you have to change the whole light. Why would you, if something has just added a color wheel or added a gobo wheel or maybe a slightly a lens alteration, why would you put a brand new, why would you get a brand new light? Why wouldn't you, you know, so...
Well, because that's how the current economy works, you know, and sound is even worse than lighting at this point. Like sound used to be where you bought a speaker system that lasted 20 years, you know, like even just look at L Acoustic or D&B, they're coming out with a new model, you know, once a year at least, you know, and that new model suddenly becomes, you know, if you're a top touring act, you've got to have this new model system, right? And that might be $2 million, you know, that somebody has to go spend. And it's just crazy. It's crazy.
I think it is still, I think there's still, audio is still, you know, the point you were making earlier about the business, is the business still a good, it's a great business to be in.
Yeah.
It's still a great business to be in. You know, you buy something for $1, for $100, you try and rent it for a couple of dollars a week. And at the end of it, you know, you try and sell it or whatever. So and then there's everything else that goes with it. It's exciting. It's we're at the edge. You know, the entertainment is fantastic. We forget to go see shows. That's the one thing that I would love to keep to remind myself more often, is that I can be involved in a tour and not even see one of the shows because there's so many going on. And not saying that the person who's actually handling it doesn't go to so many of the shows, like the actual business development. You know, person that's within our company, but me personally, I forget to go, and then you go and you're like, oh my god, this is like, now I went to see Harry Styles a couple of times. You know, he's not somebody that I would be drawn to because of my history in music, and you know, I come from a heavy metal background. Yeah. Judas Priest.
Yeah, you're a rock and roll
all
guy.
Those years. But you know, and Harry Styles, I went to see him in LA. You know, it's a 45-minute drive from my house, and I thought, oh, yes, I went to see it. It was absolutely fantastic. So just to see the energy. We have to remind ourselves sometimes why we do this, and we are lucky.
It's true.
It's so privileged.
By the way, speaking of Judas Priest, you know, a band that has been on their deathbed for 25 years or whatever, their new album is unbelievable. I don't know if you've heard
it. Oh, I've got to listen to that.
I've been a Judas Priest fan since the very beginning. Their new album, I'll tell you what, Halford... There's a song on there called, oh my God, what the heck is it called? I've just lost it. I'll remember in a minute.
It's the first thing I'm going to do. Trust me. The first thing I'm doing when I get in my car is I'm listening to
There is a song on there. I'm going to tell you what the song is called because it's his voice. He's singing better than he has in 25 years. I'm telling you right now. He is unbelievable on this album. The Serpent and the King. The Serpent and the Serpent King, and it's King. Called. I wonder. Hang on. There we go. I'm sure YouTube's going to take this down for me putting this up, but hang on. Genius. You got to hear his voice. You got to hear his voice. Listen to this. Hang on when his voice comes in. His phone sounds pretty good on here.
Exactly the same. Sounds like the Sentinel. Yeah.
74 years old. I mean, his voice is unreal on this album.
We could do a podcast called Mickey Kirbishley and Judas Priest, because I did probably 5 tours with Judas Priest from about 85 onwards. And when they were the biggest rock band in the world, you know, we were doing 2-3 nights at Madison Square Garden. We were doing every ABC market. And that was the time that it was really like being a pirate. Being a roadie was like, because what would happen was we would be every time we went to a city, they'd been waiting for months for Judas Priest to show up. Yeah. All the kids, you know, and I was a kid, I was 17, 18 years old. So, you know, if I did it now, there'd be no connection over there, but we were all the same age. So we would go to a town and we were all in our teens and everybody was waiting to see us. And they were just the greatest rock band on the planet.
They were amazing. So I got to tell you a funny story. So, I was probably 17, maybe 18, long hair, probably wearing leather pants or something and a jean jacket. And I went to see Judas Priest with a couple of my friends in Calgary. And so this would have been 83, 84, probably. You were maybe on that tour.
I would have been there. So, for sure. Yeah.
You know, I was naive as hell. I was a huge Judas Priest fan, but I was naive as hell. And I don't remember how, but we got invited backstage. I was friends with, I don't know if you knew Bear from Brimstone Productions.
No, I didn't know.
He was the local promoter in Calgary for a number of years. But anyways, I don't remember how, but I got invited backstage. And so we go into the first room in the after show thing, right? And there was no drinks or no anything. You were just standing around with a crowd of useless people with these, you know, sticky passes on. And then me and a couple of my friends and a few other people got invited into the next room. And now I'm looking around going, it's all dudes in here. Like, all the girls are gone now. What's going on? And I had no idea. At the time, believe it or not, I swear to God, I did not know that Halford was gay.
Well, yeah,
I was selected. I was one of the guys at the time. Again, you know, long hair, really tight leather pants, you know, the whole thing. I'm being selected to be introduced to Rob Halford. And so finally, I'm now part of like four people who's being selected to go in and meet Mr. Halford. And I went, I got to go. And I left with my friends. Yeah. I was out of there. That was it. I was done. So I remember the first time Halford.
The first time I ever went into their dressing room after a show and to do something, I can't remember. And they were all sitting there with their levers around their waist. They'd just come off and they'd taken their levers off. They didn't have the energy to get them past their waist because they were so tight, all their leather outfits. And they were sitting back and they were totally exhausted. And they were listening to Diana Ross, Ain't No Mountain High Enough.
That's
was on
hilarious.
Like that. And it was like, they were just the opposite to what you would expect.
That is so
then
they're
literally just having a cup of tea and a biscuit, listening to Diana Ross. And like, it was, you know, other than Rob, it was a lot of it was the show. It was it was my dad that came up with the idea of the costumes. He said, why don't you, they were looking for something and Mad Max had just come out. And he was like, you know, why don't you dress like, they got the steals from Mad Max. And that's where they took a lot of the ideas from and stuff like that.
Mickey, it's funny. When you look backwards, it's kind of like, dough, you know, because, you know, it's almost like they were taking the piss because he was dressed like that whole cruising thing, you know, with the chaps and the whole hat deal.
And he'd have the whip. He'd come out with the whip and everything.
Yeah, none of us knew that he was gay. Nobody knew he was gay, right?
I
mean, it's so funny.
I'm going to tell you very quick. I'll tell you a great Judas Priest story.
Please.
So what my job used to be at one point during the show is I would lift the staircase up. We would cover the floor in dry ice. And I would lift this staircase up because we didn't have any hydraulics. I would lift it up by hand and I would clip it off. And at the back of the stage, we would have two flight cases and we would have a Harley Davidson on the flight cases with two ramps. And we would put Rob on the Harley Davidson on these two flight cases and we would shove him and he would go down the two ramps and come under the staircase, onto the stage, through the dry ice during Hellbent for Leather.
Yeah.
And the band would be like, Hellbent for Leather. And he would glide across through the dry ice and the smoke would billow and he would just stop in the front. Anyway, it didn't always happen that way. So one night I lifted the staircase, but I didn't lift it high enough. And as he went under, it hit him on the head.
Oh.
And the bike went flying out into the orchestra pit. And he, unconscious, disappeared into the dry ice.
Oh my God. So
it was me and Mick Double and Pete Rowe and a few people were on the side of the stage. We'd seen and of course it's my fault. I haven't lifted the thing.
Oh no.
And the band are playing Hellbent for Leather. So, and the bike goes flying past them with nobody on it into the orchestra pit. And we literally had to wait for the dry ice to subside before we could see him. We didn't know where he was even.
Wow.
And then the first thing we saw was these big silver boots appeared. Like first, we'd see that as the dryers went down, we see the tips of these big silver boots. So we knew where to find
where
him,
to look for
and then
him.
And they
would
just go, they just went and dragged him off in through the ice, like they're unconscious, his head all cut open. But there was always a story like that. Every night there was a Judas Priest.
You know, Mickey, I think, I read his book, and I think that story is in his book, because as you started telling it, I'm like, I heard this before, and I'm positive it's in his book. And his book, by the way, was shocking.
I've got to read his book.
It's shocking because it's a great book from a music standpoint and just knowing the whole story and stuff, but he gets really graphic on the gay stuff. You know, like to understand, you know, that they were stopping the tour bus at truck stops so that he could go in and get some action in a truck stop, you know, stuff like that. And very graphic, you know, he didn't hold anything back, which, you know, God bless him. Yeah. He's telling the truth now, but,
I would still like to read, that book.
Great. So I'm glad I read
part
it.
Of my life. That was my youth. That was years. And I would come back from those tours, and me and Jim Lawford and a few of the other guys, we would go and we would do Antiques Roadshow for like 2 months just to stop shaking.
Yeah.
After being on the road with Judas Priest for 6 months, we would go and sit in a car park and we would light some vases and some bowls of, you know, and just
the energy behind their music, right?
Yeah. Just to break. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you follow, Cosmo on social media, but he's putting putting really great pictures up of the current show that's out. They're in, I think they were in Birmingham last night or something, but
that would have been huge.
Yeah, it looks amazing. The show looks, and I'll tell you what, again, like, God bless Rob Halford. That guy sounds better right now. Like, I remember I saw them maybe 15 years ago. I saw him again recently, but I saw him about 15 years ago, and I said, yeah, they're done. Halford, you know, he was walking with a cane and he just was sort of faking it, right? And right now, I mean, he is sounding like he's 25 years old. It's unbelievable how good he sounds. It's crazy.
I keep promising that I'll see them, and I don't want to get, you know, get to the end of their career and me not see them again, because, you know, that was such a big part of
their life. They're pulling it off, I'll tell you what. Yeah.
Amazing.
And Tipton, I guess, came out and played, I don't know if the whole night or half the night or something in Birmingham, Cosmo was saying. So
he was an amazing man, and just one of the most wonderful, you know, when you start working with a band like that, you then go on to work. I worked with Elton John over the same sort of period, and Eric Clapton, obviously, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And what it did for me was working with them, it made me, I just assumed that everybody I worked with was like that. Like, they would just sit with you whenever, they would sit at your table in catering and all that.
Yeah.
And I think it just changed the way I was with artists and with things.
That's cool.
You know, because I think sometimes we put them on a pedestal and we don't like to approach them in the, you know, sure, if you're working with Michael Jackson or someone like that, you're not going to go sit with him. But but just about everybody else, you know, during my career, I was so lucky that, you know, everyone I worked with we had the crew and everybody had relationships with. We were in it together.
It makes such a difference, you know, like when you've got a Madonna or a Prince was a weird one. Like, I remember I did something one time with Prince where it was a club, and it was like 2 days before the opening night of the club. It was in Miami, and it was right after he changed his name to The Symbol. And so I went to lunch one day with him, the lighting guy, and I think his manager or his tour manager or something. And right before we went for lunch, I asked the tour manager, I said, hey, just before we go to lunch, what do I call him? And he says, you don't. And I said, well, what if we're having a conversation and I want to say, hey, Prince, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he says, no, don't do that. And I'm like, well, so how do you address him? No, don't. And I'm like, well, this is just fucking weird. You know, like, this is stupid, you know, like, he can call me.
The first time I met him,
you know,
the first time I met him, he held his hand out like this and for me to kiss his hand like that. He literally held it out like that. And I just went and walked off, and I just got, you know, like, and it was, I was with Greg Fillinganes. And when I looked over, like, a few minutes later, he was still standing there. He was talking to somebody. And he still had his hand out like that.
You better kiss my hand.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the only time I nearly met Prince.
So, yeah. Oh, my God. So, you know, one other question I wanted to ask you around this whole sustainability and shipping and all that stuff. I know I can't keep you all day, so I'll let you go here soon. But I wanted to talk to you about this one. Do you get involved in geopolitics at all? Like, in just understanding, you know, from a standpoint of moving a tour outside of North America, moving around the world, like, you know, all this stuff with the Houthi rebels and Suez Canal and stuff, it has, it has caused so many freight problems, obviously, especially in the region, but even just, you know, ships coming over from China, you know, it's caused problems there as well. And I talked to Wiseman about this as well, because I think some people think you can just switch from shipping on the sea to shipping by air, but I don't remember the numbers, but you can fit, like, I forget how many containers in a 747 and like 100 and something times that many containers on a ship. So
yeah, if you think about it, it's a full, what we're dealing with is 40 foot containers generally, and you can get a lot of stuff in a sea container and it's going to cost you 15 grand.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, you know, it could cost you 250,000 to, to air freight it, or 300,000 or 500,000 depending.
Yeah,
on
there's less capacity.
It certainly has an impact. Yes.
There's so much less capacity. Yeah. But I mean, have you had to worry about that with any of your tours that are out in different parts of the world or anything? Like, is that, does that show up on your desk at all or no?
It's been in conversations, but it's generally what's happening now is the, you know, one of the things that we are facing, I guess, is that the revenue that's being generated from shows is so vast. It's so, you know, if you look, we all read Polestar and we all look at the, you know, the you know, just the, if you're just looking at ticket revenue for a lot of acts, you know, multiple million dollars every night. So I don't know, I'm not a promoter and I don't know for sure, but I would imagine that's impacting the fact that the festivals are struggling to find headline acts, because a headline act, you used to get paid a couple of million dollars to do a festival and you'd be like, this is fantastic, it's easy and all that. But really, they're generating so much money from their own shows now that a couple of million dollars is their merchandise cake on a normal night.
Isn't that crazy?
So what we're finding is that, I think it would have affected us a lot more, because what would happen was, if you're going to Israel, for instance, everything, you know, that's going on there, you would that obviously there's a much bigger conversation around that. But if you were just using it as an example of sending stuff, you would put it on a boat. The artist would take a week off and you would go do shows in that region. Now they make so much money. They can just fly everything in to do a show and fly everything back out again. And so what we're finding is there's an issue with, there's no downtime anymore, which is a big thing. So there's a lot of conversations recently at the ILMC about the well-being of crew and about the, you know, their, when I was a roadie, what would happen is it was like you would go away. It was like you would join a circus. You would go away for a couple of months. You would come home for a month and then you'd go away again. And you'd make enough money to come home and not have to work for the time you were home. That was the game. That was all it was about. Now, I've no crew that have not had a day off for 2 years because they can fly the stuff directly. They can jam everything in. So I would hope that for people's well-being, maybe it will. Maybe these global effect the events that are going on to start slowing things down, maybe will slow down the actual touring cycle and allow people to have some breathing time and some home time.
Yeah. I mean, that would be amazing, wouldn't it? So, you know, anything else, anything that we've missed, anything, you know, big you see happening this year, any crazy predictions?
Just looking at my board, I wrote a bunch of stuff down there, but I think I covered it all. No, like I say, I know we just went through the International Women's Day, and I would tip my hat to the way, you know, I went to the TPI Awards in the UK recently, and you know, as an example of the impact that the women are making in our industry, I think half of the awards went to females in the TPI Awards and to you know, monitor engineers, audio engineers. I don't know them by name because I haven't toured for so long. But to me, that was something that really stood out to me was, you know, my wife, Jo Little, we met while she was a production. She was one of those early female production managers, started off as a production assistant. And, you know, there wasn't that many females in the industry at that point, but now it really, that's something that
at every level too, like lighting techs,
attention to, yeah.
Lighting techs, sound techs,
riggers. The rigger of the year was a girl.
That's incredible.
You know? And that's not being so funny, but it's like, you know, why not? But also it was to me, it was just like a revelation. And I, you know, I really, I've been lucky enough to work with so many great females, Jo Mackay, Yvonne from that's now, you know, a very prominent at PRG. You know, and you know, I'm surround myself with there's a lot of females here at Solartek that I work with.
Yeah.
That have done a great job. So yeah, that was one thing I wanted to make sure that I acknowledge.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and there's some really great female designers, Sooner and others, who
Sooner's
are
like Sooner was a Sooner, yeah. You can carry on, but Sooner, she just changed everything, didn't she? She was she's such a beautiful woman, such a beautiful person, and she did so much for that. But yeah.
But the thing is, Mickey, I think we're now getting to the point, and I actually talked about this last week. I had Miriam from LDI on the podcast last week. And we've gotten to the point now where Sooner's a great LD, not a great female LD. She's a great LD, you know,
exactly.
Whoever that was is a great rigger, not a great female rigger. Like, you don't really have to differentiate or discuss their gender as much because they're just great, you know, and that's a good thing. That means that, you know, that line has been crossed and it doesn't really matter anymore, you know?
It's done now. Yeah, that's the point that we need to, as I said, that's, you know, we've got to continue to make sure that we support each other and everything. And the tour, I think that the one thing as well that does concern me is the well-being of crew on the road.
Yeah.
I think that during COVID, we had a lot of, when we COVID cleared and we had all these conversations about, you know, how we were going to be different and this and that. I would question whether we've improved or got worse.
It's gotten worse. Yeah, I mean,
I think that's a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree, but that's a tough one to fix because it's a compounded problem with the fact that we have less crew available now. So we're already short on people. Mm-hmm. Every tour, every company, every shop is short on people. A lot of the people coming in are new, which means that the people who are more veteran have to carry a bit more weight. They've got to train the new people plus do their own job. Mm-hmm. I just think that there's a lot of reasons that's probably not going to get better anytime soon unless people just do less and smaller shows, and that ain't going to happen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's too much of a financial engine behind this whole thing right now to where we got to just find a way to keep up, right?
Yeah, I think that you just made me think about something about me. How did I get started? I was a 16-year-old guy cutting gel at Tasco in the back room, and I went to do a load-in for Elton John at Bray Studios with Steve Arch and all these legendary people. And they just said, let's just keep him, have another guy. You know, in those days, you know, having another guy on the road, it wasn't that big a deal. You know, the buses had 12 bunks and it was, they were going to pay me $100 a day if that, including per diem and everything. So nowadays, you know, you put an extra person on the road, it changes everything.
Yeah.
It's just so you're not getting that entry level, you know. Yeah, you know, I just a quick story about Madonna. Years ago, I had a call from the production manager for Madonna years ago, and he said, look, we're having real trouble with our follow spot operators. Everywhere we go, we can't get consistency. It's a mess. Can you send me four of your warehouse people to tour just to do the follow spots? And we did. And we sent them four people from the warehouse, and they all ended up being road guys. You know, one of them ended up, Harry, ended up being one of the best crew chiefs we ever had, you know?
Wow.
And he was someone that was sweeping the floor in the warehouse, and he went out and he ended up tour managing, you know, multiple shows himself. So those opportunities, we need to, maybe that's somewhere where we should focus, getting those opportunities together.
Yeah. And sometimes it's just education. It's just, you know, like Sooner was the one who told me this on the podcast. She said, you know, that the problem is so many people still see us as an industry of gypsies and there's no money in it. And you're going to go on the road and live this crazy gypsy lifestyle and you're not going to make any money and it's not a career and it's just a way to have fun and meet girls. But that's not really true anymore. Maybe that was true at one point, you know, when you started. But today, you know, a person can make $100,000 a year, you know, in their first couple of years touring. And see the world and have a really great gig and learn some really cool stuff and meet some amazing people. And it can become a very good career.
Maybe if we made it easier for them to get a mortgage and things like that, that might help. Yeah. Because sometimes that's part of it as well. People are like, I can't even get a mortgage because I haven't got the thing. Maybe that's something that we could work on. I don't know.
Well, but you know
anyway,
what?
I'm
Again,
sure.
talking about it, paying attention to people's mental health, having resources available, having like one of the sponsors of today's podcast was the ESA, the Entertainment Safety Alliance. You know, having organizations like that who are looking at not just the safety of the gear and the safety of the setup and rigging and all of those things, but also mental health, looking at you know, how people are being treated or how people feel or whatever. It's important, you know, it's important to pay attention to these things. So,
yeah. Keep the conversation going.
Mickey, I appreciate you. And congratulations on all your incredible success. And I'm glad California has been so good to you. You look amazing. And I hope to see you in real person one of these days, as opposed to constantly on Zoom and friggin' podcasts and stuff. But
let me know when you're passing through.
Yeah.
I'm around. I'm in LA. There's lots to show you.
Yeah, I was just out there recently and had no time at all. I had to go for a board meeting and I was in and out in a couple of days, but
I'll show you the new rehearsal space. We have two rehearsal spaces here in the middle of Hollywood that I'll show you.
Oh, really? How big are they?
They're about, one's 8,000 square feet and one is 5,000 square feet.
How tall?
Yeah, you know, it's big. 30 foot.
Okay. So you could,
they're proper rehearsal spaces, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we've got Peso Pluma coming in next week. Justin Timberlake's here at the moment.
Cool.
Rehearsing or doing it. He's actually doing a shoot in there, a film shoot. But then you've got Peso Pluma here for a few weeks. I think J-Lo is going to come in when she does her
Interesting.
Stuff. Steve Dixon.
That's a big thing right now, huh? Like everyone's telling me that. Like I had Creech on a few weeks ago and he said one of the biggest challenges right now is finding space to rehearse because every venue is full constantly.
Yeah.
So
call me.
Cool. All right, my friend.
really loved it. And really love you talking to you as always. And thank
as
you for having me on.
Perfect. Thank you.
Cheers.